Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With one of the best savings rates in America, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. Even easier than choosing Slash to be in your band.
Next up for lead guitar. You're in.
Cool.
Yep, even easier than that. And with no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, is it even a decision? That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.
You're right there, Luke.
Sorry, I kept hitting the wrong button. Welcome to the Long May You Young bonus episode.
Yes, welcome. Thank you. We're part of the Pantheon Podcast Network, and I want to thank Christian Swain.
Yes.
Who's one of the guys who runs the Pantheon Podcast Network for helping us get producer and musician extraordinaire Danny Korchmar.
Yeah, pretty bitchin'.
To us. Yeah. Yeah,
it was pretty wild.
It was pretty wild.
If you don't know Danny Korchmar, he produced the album Landing on Water, which we just talked about, which we all had mixed reviews on. Overall, pretty...
And this was recorded before we did that episode.
Yes. Overall, very prolific dude. Incredible career.
He's worked with everybody. Yep. Carole King, James Taylor. I think, Russ, you mentioned John Lennon.
Yeah.
I think he worked with
Ringo
Simon and Garfunkel.
Too,
yeah, Ringo Starr.
And then
Paul McCartney.
Because of our interview with him, I was able to go back and listen to some of his early solo stuff, I think from the 70s. Really, really fucking good.
That album
is really good. Yeah.
I think you compared him to Little Feat.
That album has a very Little Feat vibe to it. It's got kind of a funky Southern soul kind of thing going on, which is really good. And he's a great musician.
I think he just, you'll hear.
Cool. He doesn't exactly agree with some of my opinions anyway.
Yeah. If you want to listen to more Danny Korchmar, you should check out The Immediate Family. That's the band that he's in with a bunch of big names.
Super session guys.
Yeah.
Because he's done sessions with like Wadi Wattel and Russ Kunkel.
And it's great. The album's Slippin' and Slidin'.
Yep.
Really, really great EP. I think he said it's going to be a full album. The problem is, Mike, I didn't look up how to get an interview going. You don't have anything that I could play that could show us how to get an interview going, do you?
Well, I just happen to have this VHS tape with an instructional video.
Let's pop it in.
Yeah. Welcome to How to Start Your Interview. When starting an interview, try to not make it awkward by saying, "Hey, we think you're great," or "love your work," but get right into it. Maybe something that has nothing to do with what you're originally going to talk about. And then shortly after that, try to piss off your subject by telling him his work sucks. Good luck and have fun doing that interview.
Oh, I love it. Anyway.
But we are grateful that we got to.
Yeah, it was very nice talking to him. The guy's a legend.
A fucking legend.
And
it's fucking
probably the
great interview.
Last time we'll ever talk to him.
not on our one.
No, he'll talk to you guys. Yeah, he'll never talk to me again. That's for sure.
Well, we had a great time and a good conversation, and here it is.
This is our Neil Young podcast, where we mostly talk out of our ass while going through the works of Mr. Young. It's Mike Hsu and the Condon Boys, Trans and Harvest and Linois. We're gonna sit and listen to each one.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Danny?
Yes, me.
Hi, Danny.
Okay, you are calling me about Neil Young, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I missed your call. I don't understand why it didn't ring. My phone didn't ring, but it didn't.
Okay.
So, well, anyway, here I am.
I'm glad you got back to us. Thank you very much for doing that.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Well, we do a podcast. First of all, my name is Mike, and you're also talking to Luke and Russ.
Hey.
And we do a podcast called Long May You Young. And what we do is we're covering Neil Young's catalog by release. So we're getting to Landing on Water very soon. And thanks to Christian Swain, we're part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. He put you in touch with us. So we appreciate you talking to us about this.
Oh, certainly.
But first, can we just talk about how you were, like, part of some of the most, like, pivotal moments in popular music history, which is pretty amazing. You know, and for those that don't know, Danny, it's Korchmar, right? Am I saying that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you were part of Carole King, her album Tapestry. Not only did you play guitar on it, but you'd help write some of the songs, right?
Not on Tapestry, no.
Oh, okay.
No. I've written songs with lots of cool people, but not Tapestry. I just played guitar on that one.
Oh, okay. Still though.
Yeah.
That's pretty huge. And then you not only played, did you play on Sweet Baby James?
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so not only did you play on that, but you also were in a band with James Taylor, like, way back in the day.
That's true.
Yeah. And you were probably, you know, really part of Linda Ronstadt's rising popularity in the 70s. And then you worked with David Crosby and Graham Nash also.
Yeah.
And most importantly, though, and I think this is probably the one that really, I mean, just nailed it for me anyway, was you were in Spinal Tap.
The absolute zenith of my career.
Yeah. I mean, you were there in the beginning. You weren't there during the, you know, the puppet show days. You were there, you know, when they were just starting out.
Yeah, that's right. I was in the Thamesmen.
Yes. Thamesmen back then. Oh my gosh.
That's right. If you look at the film, there's a clip of them doing "Give Me Some Money," right?
Right.
And I am the bass. I'm the bass player. I'm playing bass.
Wow.
That's amazing. You were part of the loudest band in the world. Well, not at that time.
Well, that's what they say. Let me tell you, that's what always gets people. When I'm telling them I'm in Spinal Tap, that always gets a big rise. So it's a lot of fun to have that credit.
And then also you were in the Fugs, which I thought was pretty, which I thought was pretty awesome.
Right.
Now, was that before or after you worked in England for a little while?
I never worked in England.
Oh, see, I thought you were, I read you were a session person in England for a little while.
Not true.
Oh, well, I'm glad we got that out of the way.
I never lived there. We went over there to play several times. But I never did sessions. I was never a session guy in England.
Fucking Wikipedia.
I know, man. Fuck Wikipedia.
Yeah, wrong.
Damn it. Yeah. Well, I'm glad we asked. That's why we're talking to you. We like to fact check things because we have a lot of, most of the time when we can get people to actually give us the truth. And that's why we want you on, because we're going to be talking about Neil Young's album Landing on Water, which you are a co-producer of.
And so
we just wanted to give people a little background. And then these days you're in a band called the Immediate Family.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. You just had an album come out, or an EP, sorry.
We have an EP coming out. Well, it's out now, and we have an album coming out next year.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Very nice.
We're also working on a documentary. There's a documentary being made about us.
Oh, nice.
By Denny Tedesco, who did the Wrecking Crew documentary.
Oh, wow.
Sweet. Oh, perfect.
That's awesome.
And and that's like you were basically, you weren't part of the Wrecking Crew, but you were part of that group of studio musicians like through the 70s and 80s that were just, you were omnipresent. You guys were everywhere. You and Russ Kunkel. Right. And
we kind of came after the Wrecking Crew. And, you know, Leland has done more sessions than any of us. He got to work with those fellas a little bit. But, you know, just before there was the changing of the guard kind of thing.
And Leland Sklar's in the Immediate Family. Russ Kunkel's in Immediate Family. And who else is in it?
Waddy Wachtel, my dear friend.
All right.
And Steve Postel, who's a newer friend. Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Nice. Well, I guess our first question would be, how did you meet Neil? Can you kind of get into that a little bit?
Well, everybody back in the day, everyone knew everybody, everyone hung out with everybody. So I can't remember when I actually met Neil, but I met him and Skills and Crosby, all them fellas, around the same time. Like I said, up in Laurel Canyon, everybody knew everybody else, and everybody was hanging out with everybody. So it's hard to pinpoint exactly when I met Neil, but I'll tell you, we did a session together, he and I. It was a Monkees tune. It was for the Monkees album Head, their movie. They made a movie called Head, if you remember.
Yeah.
Jack Nicholson was directed it. I think he wrote it. And
jeez. Wow.
So we played on the soundtrack. So it's the soundtrack. And there's a tune on there called As We Go Along that Carole King and Jerry Goffin wrote. And there were three guitar players on it. Myself, Neil, and Ry Cooter.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
That's some good guitar playing.
That's some heavy guitar playing right there, yeah.
Yeah, I know. How much fun is that, right?
Yeah. So I think
that's the first time I got to play with Neil. That was the first time I ever played that I got to play with Neil.
Now, before we get into Landing on Water, I just want to preface this just to be completely transparent and upfront with you. And I can't speak for Luke or Russ. This is Mike.
Okay.
Up to this point in our podcast, this is what, in my humble opinion, Neil Young's worst album. And I just want to put that up front because I don't want to be like, oh, yeah, everything's great and everything. I just want you to know where I'm coming from. I just think that although I've warmed up to it over the years, especially the last three songs on the album, which is I Got a Problem, Pressure, and Drifter, I believe.
Well, I'd have to say to you in response to that right away, I'd have to say that Neil does not care.
Yes. Yes.
That's why we're making this podcast.
Yeah.
That's why we love Neil.
That's why we love Neil, because he just doesn't care and he does whatever the fuck he wants and he doesn't, you know. Although it seemed like, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seemed to me like he really did care at this point because of other things that were going on in his life, especially with Geffen. And Geffen was like, after we just did Everybody's Rockin', the album before this. Mm-hmm. Or no, Old Ways was before this. But we just did that. And that's when the problems with Geffen started and they prevented him from recording and stuff like that. So my question to you right off is, did Neil want you for this project, or did you were already working with Don Henley, who was on Geffen. And so did they say, why don't you get in there and try to make a hit album for Neil?
No, that never happened, and that never would happen. Neil, like I told you, he doesn't care.
Yeah.
Mm. And it wouldn't matter who suggested me or anyone else. He marches, as you well know, if you know anything about Neil, he marches to his own drummer, and he follows his own heart and his own instincts. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd also have to tell you, since we're talking about it, that I've produced a lot of albums, about 20 years worth of record production, as you said, Don Henley and a bunch of other people. Mm. And of all the records I made, that is like top 4 or 5 albums that I love. And I think it is absolutely brilliant. I just listened to it and I still think it's absolutely fucking brilliant. Okay. Now I said my
okay. All right. Well, I respectfully disagree in that part.
Well,
and
yeah, that you may disagree with me, but I know better than you.
No, I understand that completely.
True.
Yeah,
that's
you
true.
Were there. And you put a lot of work into it for sure. But
it's not just that. It's that I work with, because you just named some of the people I work with, so I know what the fuck I'm talking about. When I say it's great, pal. Maybe you ought to listen again.
Believe me, I've listened several times since the album came out.
It's a great, great, great album, in my not so humble opinion.
Well, Neil himself said, I think I'm quoting here, let's be honest about it. If I was going to give one of my records to somebody, I don't think this would be the one.
Mm-hmm. No. Then he's wrong too. Great.
Yeah, Neil usually is wrong about his music.
But again, if he's wrong, he still doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
Which is why we love
Neil
Young. Absolutely.
Like I said, he follows his nose and he follows his instincts and he does what he's feeling at the time. Which is why he kept making all those different records. He made Everybody's Rocking because he felt like making a rock and roll record, like a rockabilly type record.
Now, were you?
And he did.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, were you kind of around when he was making Everybody's Rockin'? We just did that that album. We had we've literally, I think, what are we on?
We're going on
25th episode here.
Yeah.
But we've gone from the beginning, and we're huge Neil fans. And I think one of the things we admire about him the most is, like you said, he doesn't give a shit. He does
what he wants, and he doesn't do it for anybody but himself, and we we love that. But were you around when he did Everybody's Rockin'? Because we had kind of mixed reviews on maybe why he made that, and because we know that he originally had proposed a certain kind of style thing to Geffen, and then Geffen said, no, I want this, and then Neil came out with Everybody's Rockin'. We heard he there's rumors that he recorded it in like 2 hours. Were you around during that time?
Well, no, I wasn't working with Neil. I was in L.A., and like I said, everybody knew everybody, but I don't think I ran into Neil when he was making that record.
Oh, okay.
But again, he wouldn't do what anybody said. It didn't matter what Geffen had to say. He was going to do what he wanted. He made that record because he wanted to make a rockabilly record, period.
Okay.
That's what he made.
And was that the same thing with Landing on Water? Like
Exactly. That's the same thing with every album he's ever made, okay? I promise you.
Well,
that's the way it is. That's the way he does it.
Right.
But like, how much did you have to do with it? Because that's what we've learned about Neil, is that once he's in this, he's the one, the pretty much the gatekeeper. So you could have all the ideas in the world, you know, of all the your experience, and then he could just say, nah, you know, he's got the final say, right? So how much of that was he taking from you?
Well, it was a total collaboration. I don't remember him, you know, he didn't order any of us around. He didn't say, oh, I don't like that, don't do that, do this. He got us in there because he trusted us. He trusted the people that were in there. And he called me because of the stuff I had done with Henley, which had a lot of synthesizers and a lot of programming. And he had just gotten a Synclavier. I don't know if you guys know what a Synclavier is.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of the early. All right. And he was fooling around with that and decided he wanted to use it to make his next record. And he knew I knew about, you know, various electronic keyboards and stuff because we did a lot of Henley. We used that stuff on Henley's record a lot, you know. So he felt that I would be a good call. That's why I got the call to work on that.
Because I read in Jimmy McDonough's book, Shaky, that you said it doesn't matter who produces Neil. Neil could get one of those professional wrestlers to co-produce, and it will still come out the same.
But, yes, that's true.
But he was taking your ideas. He was receptive to it. Okay.
Do you have a song?
Yeah, he was.
Do you have a song off of Landing on Water that, like, speaks to you particularly? Like, do you have, like, a favorite off of that one?
Well, you know, there's so many. Bad News Beat, I think it's fantastic.
Yep.
I Got a Problem is great. People on the Street is great. Hippie Dream is great.
Dream, I think, is my favorite off of the album, I think, if I had to pick one. So
I haven't really introduced myself. I'm Russ. I Got a Problem is probably one of my favorites. I was just reading the lyrics to that one too. And the interesting thing about this podcast that we're doing, because we're going through album by album, and so it's funny that we're getting into the 80s now, and it's, you know, obviously you can't ignore how, I don't even know the right words, but the early stuff of Neil is just so profound and so sort of, I don't know, culturally shaking. And, you know, we're getting into the 80s, and you sort of see these shifts in Neil, and it's funny because all three of us have different perspectives on what we like and don't like. And so Mike obviously feels a certain way about this album, and Luke and I might feel a different way, but each album we all are sort of like, these are things I like, these are things I don't like. And like we've been saying, one of the things we say on this podcast, we have a saying, which is just fucking Neil, man, because no matter what you think, it's always just fucking Neil, man, you know? And
let me interject and say that you guys should be more like Neil. He listens to everything and brings everything in. There is no kind of music he doesn't like.
Right.
He doesn't care. You know, if you like acoustic music, he does too. But he also likes hard rock, which is what Landing on Water is, if it's hard rock.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I would say to you guys, have the Catholic taste with a small C, like Neil does.
Right.
You know, you know, just because, you know, if you love old ways, that doesn't mean you can't love this album.
Right.
I personally listen to all kinds of music, you know. I listen to acoustic music. I listen to hard rock. I love AC/DC. I love Joni Mitchell. You know, everything. Why not?
Danny, I have to say that I'm the same way. I listen to what I like, and it covers a lot of diverse styles of music. We were just, you know, during our trans episode, you know, I was talking about how much I love, you know, listening to Kraftwerk and Neu and, you know, some of the German stuff that was started in the early 70s and stuff he was taking from like that. I'm a huge fan of death metal. You know, I'm a big Slayer fan. So, and I also love Joni Mitchell. I mean, I have a very, I like to think, you know,
you
I have
do.
A very open mind about music because I just like what I like. And I'll tell you right now, we love Neil Young, and we dedicate this time to do a podcast to him, but we're not like sycophants. We're not going to be kissing his ass. We don't think everything he did, obviously don't think everything he did was perfect. And we're not afraid to say, you know, what we like and what we don't like.
Of course.
And we do that. And I like to think we do that with, you know, maybe not as much as you, but a somewhat educated opinion on different styles of music. I mean, Russ and Luke are in a band called Town Meeting, and they mix a bunch of different styles of music together. And they write songs. They're musicians also. So I like to think that we approach the podcast like you would like us to.
Yeah,
with an open mind about music.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, listen, it's great that you're you know, paying attention to Neil's career and all the albums he made. He's so prolific and has done so much great stuff that obviously there's. And now he has his archives coming out. He's going to release every single thing he ever that he ever recorded, which is a lot of stuff, you know.
Yeah,
can't keep him down. He's irrepressible. No. You can't keep him down.
Yeah, and he's doing the Hi-Rez thing on he has like an app and you can do the archives and listen in Hi-Rez and everything, and he's just always got his finger on the pulse of, you know, just what's happening in music and culture and even things with social justice. He doesn't, like you said, you just can't keep him down. And that's something we really love about him. And do you have any cool stories as far as working with Neil and some of that sort of not give a fuck type of mentality with him, or just things you guys might have, cool, positive interactions, mediocre things.
Or negative interactions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as for not giving a fuck, he doesn't give a fuck about what other people think about him.
Yeah.
But he definitely cares very deeply about what he's making.
Yeah.
And that it have and that it be up to his standards.
Right.
As for the process of making Landing on Water, when I went to see Neil to start talking about this, as soon as he talked to me, you know, he said he'd be interested in co-producing. I said absolutely. It took me a quarter of a second to say, "You bet." You know. And the next thing I did was to call Nico Bolas and Steve Jordan. Now, Steve Jordan you must know about Steve Jordan. He's one of the absolute finest musicians of his generation.
Yeah, I totally agree.
One of the greatest drummers ever, ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've played with them all. So, Nico Bolas is a fantastic audio engineer who ain't afraid of volume. He's not afraid of that big beat. And he's not afraid of the volume, you know, of just intent. You know, we listen back loud.
Right.
So that was my first move as producer, and I could have left then, you know, although I played on all of it, so I couldn't have left then, but that was my main contribution in a way, because, you know, getting those two cats in, that set it up. Neil recognized immediately both those guys were great, and he loved both those guys. So we walk into the studio, Record One, back room in Record One, and Neil's stuff is there. He hasn't arrived yet, but his stuff is there. And there's Old Black, right, his Gibson guitar.
Oh, nice.
So Steve Jordan, who's irrepressible, grabs it and starts banging away on it and starts rolling around on the floor while he's playing.
Jeez.
And Neil walks in. And Neil starts laughing, you know. It's hilarious. Here's Steve rolling on the ground like he's playing, a lead solo. It's hysterically funny. You know, and other people might go, "Oh, my God, he's touching Old Black." Oh, my God. Not Neil.
Yeah.
Not Neil.
Really? That's amazing.
That's all right.
I would have been. Right. I would have said he would have been. I mean, Old Black in my mind is this like god of an instrument. I can't even imagine walking in and doing that. That's awesome.
Well, yeah, he's got a lot of really good guitars, and you know what? If Old Black broke or was stolen or something, he'd pick up another one. And you know who he'd sound like? Neil Young.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true. Very true. Neil, man. Yeah. So let's talk about Steve Jordan a little bit. He is an amazing musician. He's a great producer himself also.
That's right.
In my opinion. But something Nico Bolas said was that it was all about the drums. Drums, drums, and more fucking drums. And I think you may have said in that book I mentioned earlier in Shaky that Neil Young was the only guy who could wear Steve Jordan out because he was obsessed with the drum sound. He wanted that big, giant drum sound. And there were stories the stories of the floor being littered with broken drumsticks because Steve Jordan wasn't playing hard enough.
Well, not true. None of that is true. The floor being littered with drumsticks might be true, but Steve, he goes for it immediately. He doesn't need to be told or directed or aimed in a direction. He knew what to do. And he started slamming away. And Nico knew how to record him. We didn't, you know, from what you're saying, it sounds like we spent hours or days on the drum sound. We didn't. We started recording the day Neil got there, the first day we got there. We got a drum sound immediately, and we hit it. So, yes, he wanted big drums, but there's a lot of other stuff on that. There's the synclavier. There's all those synth parts. So it's not just about the drums, although the drums, I think, are spectacular on that record.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely brilliant. The record, the way they're recorded, and definitely the way they're played.
Yeah.
And then there's no actual, is there no actual bass on this album?
That's right. No bass. It's all synth bass or something off the synclavier, or I played it on a keyboard.
And, oh, wow.
And whose decision was that? Was that your decision as a producer? Was that Neil's decision? Or was that like a budget thing? Like you didn't want to bring another guy in?
It definitely wasn't a budget thing. It was, I think Neil wanted synth bass, but I can't really remember. But I set up my keyboard. I think it was a DX7 and started playing bass. I don't remember it. You know, we just hit it. There was very little discussion. You know, Neil trusted me to come up with stuff that would work, and he never said, no, don't do that, don't do that. He never said that ever. Mm. So, you know.
Whose idea?
That guy was pretty good at... Go ahead.
I was going to say, whose idea was the boys choir, the San Francisco boys choir? I thought that was a cool touch.
Well, that was definitely Neil's idea, and I thought he was nuts. You know, I couldn't understand where he was coming from with the boys choir. But again, you know, now I just listened to the album just now, and it actually works very well.
Yeah.
I was surprised. I thought it was a weird kind of move, but in listening to it back, I realized it was a really good move, and it works very, very well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
So I was also reading that you left the sessions before they were done because, now tell me if this is true, and this is why we're having you on. You left the sessions later on because Neil kept messing with the music. Like he did, you'd say it was finished, and he just kept messing with it. Is that true?
No, I don't think that he wasn't really messing with the music. He wanted to. It was about mixing, and at that point, I was kind of unnecessary. I didn't leave, and I certainly didn't leave in a huff or any kind of bad vibes. At that point, Neil and his pal Tim Mulligan and Nico were mixing and doing the whole thing. I was a little unsure because he wanted to mix off the monitor board, which is just what you listen back on. And usually you go over to the actual console and so you can use the EQ off the console. But Neil liked it with the sound that was getting off the monitor board.
Yeah.
And if he likes it, that's the way it goes. But, you know, there was no conflict at all that I can remember. No conflict at all with Neil. And no, I did not, you know, if he was messing with it, it's his to mess with. It's his album, you know.
Right.
So it's his music. It's his song. So I wouldn't have interfered. And also, just listening to it now, it sounds perfect. I don't hear anything that was changed from the original recordings of it or at any point.
Let's see, that's another thing I was going to ask you was like, if you could do something different on the album, if there was a song where something you're like, well, I wish we would have done this. Was there anything like that on Landing on Water?
Absolutely not. The only thing I would have changed is I would have had it say, all songs written by Danny Korchmar. Yeah.
Did you offer Neil any songwriting at all for this?
No, I didn't know. It was all about him, and I just was trying to come up with parts that I thought would work for what he was doing.
If you find a way to go back in time and add yourself to writing credits, can you throw us on there too?
Not just take his.
Yeah.
I will say, Danny, not to change subjects too much, but I had only heard of you in a producer type aspect, and obviously your guitar playing before this, and then so before. We hopped onto this album. I went back and listened to your album Cooch.
Oh yeah.
And I really, really dug that one, man. That's got some funky stuff on it, man. I just want to let you know, I really like that.
Yeah. That was, I enjoy listening to that too.
I'm glad we talked to you because we're talking to you, but two, because Luke said, you got to listen to Cooch.
Yeah, it's really good. You guys,
he texted me and I was like, oh, and I love that record. I love that a lot, man. I love that sound. Yeah. And was that
the
guys?
That's so nice of you to say.
Was that all those guys? Who was on that? Was that Russ Kunkel on that and Lee Sklar?
It was mostly me. I played drums and bass.
Oh,
and
wow.
Some keyboards on it.
Wow.
And then I had William Smith played organ on it on one tune.
Nice.
And that was about it. I wanted to do it all myself. I wanted to play all the instruments. So
nice.
Basically I did and then added some of the fellas in there. But Russ and Lee weren't on that one.
Okay. Nice.
And then you had another album in 1980? You came out with another album?
Yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then after that, it's just been the the immediate family now, right?
Well, after that, I started working with Henley on his album.
Well, yeah, but as far as your own recordings, like
at that point, you know, yes, I stopped trying. I didn't want to be a solo artist. I never wanted to be a solo artist. In fact, you know, I always wanted to be in a band, but it just wasn't happening. You know, immediate family. Now everyone's around and can be in a band. But back then, everyone was gone. Everyone was either doing sessions or on the road all the time. So it was impossible to actually start a band.
Right.
Yeah. How are you guys faring in today's climate with the pandemic going on? Are you able to get together at all, or what are you guys doing?
Well, we don't get together as much as we'd like. That's for sure. But we did a virtual concert that will be streamed again. I'm not sure when, but it was streamed once a couple of weeks ago. It will be streamed again. It's us playing live at a soundstage.
Sweet.
And, you know, we have, as you said, an EP out now and an album that's going to come out next year. And yes, we miss, listen, we really, just like everybody else, we miss playing live.
Yeah.
Rock and roll is supposed to be played for an audience.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
What we want to do is play live. Of course, we have to wait until it's safe, until audiences will come to shows.
Yeah.
So until then, we're going to record. We're going to do more videos. We've already done 3 or 4 videos of our tunes. We'll do more of that.
Yeah.
We'll do some more recording. At least we can get together to record because none of us have the virus. So we can do that. And that's about it. We had gigs booked, you know, as I'm sure everyone did. And actually, everything got canceled.
Are you still doing session work while this is going on?
Actually, no. I haven't. You know, I stopped doing sessions like in the 80s, in the early 80s. As soon as I started working with Henley, I got kind of kicked upstairs and became a producer. At that point, I didn't do sessions anymore, and I didn't tour anymore either. You know?
Wow. So how is it? To me, Don Henley seems like someone. He seems like he would have the same personality as Neil Young, where he knows exactly what he wants. And, you know, you can't really tell him what to do. Is it kind of the same way, or is he also like Neil, which I was surprised, like receptive to new ideas?
Well, Henley was definitely receptive to new ideas. When I started working with him, Glenn Frey had already made a solo album. The Eagles had broken up, and Glenn Frey had already made a solo album. So Henley felt he had to jump in the game and make his own solo album. So when I came up to his crib and started talking to him about it, first thing we said was, we're not going to have any oohs or ah background parts, right? We're not going to have any B harmony singing. We're not going to have any, he didn't want to have any acoustic guitar on there at all.
Wow.
You know, because of, it might remind people of the Eagles. He just wanted to go in the opposite direction of what the Eagles had done and carve his own path. But he isn't a musician. Neil is a terrific guitar player. Don is a drummer.
Yeah.
So it's hard to write songs on the drum, you know.
Right.
Yeah. That's true.
Mm-hmm. And what about working with David Crosby? Mm-hmm. You worked at David Crosby at a time where, I don't know, he seemed like he was pretty messed up. I mean, were those tough sessions?
Well, actually, yeah. He was, the Crosby Nash sessions, which were a lot of fun. We did a couple of albums and a live album, and we toured a few times, the same band. And it was a lot of fun. We loved the hell out of it. I mean, Crosby and Nash at that time, and I'm sure still, really, really love music and really take it and just love it, take it seriously. And they love to get out there and get an audience going. And so we had a ball doing that. I never saw any real, I'm not going to go into it, but there was some bad behavior, but not much, not that much. Not anywhere near like what Crosby is known for, you know.
Right.
Back in the day, there was always bad behavior by somebody, you know.
Oh yeah.
Sometimes me, you know.
No,
not you, Cooch.
not me.
And then you also worked with the Spin Doctors.
Oh really?
Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I made an album there.
And what was
it? You worked with fucking John Lennon too.
Did you work with John Lennon?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Ringo.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wild, man.
I got to play with all of them at one point or another. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So, that was pretty great. And that's because one of my best and most dear friends is Jim Keltner, and Jim was very close
with all the Beatles and all the Stones. So yeah. I got to meet all of them.
And Jim has Jim has a Neil connection too, I think, right? Isn't Jim on
Jim has played with Neil a bunch of times.
Yep.
Yes, he has, that's right.
The one that comes to the top of mind was like it was around 2000. He was doing a tour because I just saw a video of him and Donald Duck Dunn.
Oh yeah,
and, that's right.
I forget who else, but they were rehearsing. You ever play with those guys, Donald Duck Dunn, or any of those Stax guys?
Well, unfortunately, I never played with Duck Dunn, but those Stax Volt records. Let me tell you, when I was in high school, that's all I listened to. I loved them, and what I loved the most was how their interaction with each other. The fact that they played so beautifully in the ensemble. And Steve Cropper was actually my first real guitar hero. Well, maybe I guess BB King was my first, but Steve Cropper was monumental in my idea of guitar playing, and I learned a tremendous amount from him. Or you could say I stole a tremendous amount from him. Either way.
That's what we all do. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what was the session that sticks out in your mind that was the most fun, that was the most invigorating? Because someone like you who has worked with everybody, you know, does it get to be like a job after a while? And, you know, which was the session where you were just like, God, it's like it can never get better than this?
Oh, you know, I've had so many incredible experiences because look at the people I've worked with. These are like, you know, absolute geniuses, you know, like Jackson Browne's Running on Empty. I did that with that. And that was an incredible experience. We all loved it.
Yeah.
That was a great, great tour. And we all absolutely loved making that record and doing that tour.
Can I ask you real quickly about Running on Empty? So, So you were part of that tour. You were part of the band that was recording that album. Is that right?
That's right.
So were you on the bus when he was doing the recordings also?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Now, whose idea was it to put that album together? Because that's a really, for that time, I thought it was a really unique idea because he recorded songs on the bus. He had a song with Glenn Frey in a hotel room. That's where some bad behavior could have been happening. I don't know if you were present for that one. and then he was like playing in dressing rooms and stuff like that. Whose idea was it to put that album together like that?
Well, there's only one person that could come up with that idea, and that's Jackson.
Okay.
And that way, he's very similar to Neil. You know, once he gets an idea in his head, that's what he wants to do, and he's going to pursue it with dogged determination. So he's very much like Neil in that way. It was his idea all the way down the line, the whole thing was.
Guys. Because that's one of just the greatest albums of all time. It's just, and I just think it's because of the way it was recorded. It was just.
You got to remember the way I came up and the people that I grew up with, starting in the very late 60s into the 70s, nobody told them what to do. You know, you want to go and tell Crosby, Stills, and Nash what to do? Good luck. You know, they'll throw you out on your ass. No one told any of those guys what to do or what to play. That was only later that during the reign of the A&R man, when A&R guys started terrifying their various clients with you know, that records wouldn't be promoted unless they did this or that. But this is the people I worked with were never affected by that at all. You can't tell Linda Ronstadt or Jackson Browne what to do. He'll just laugh in your face, you know. So that was one of the great things. It wasn't the music industry; it was music.
Right.
Yeah. And I feel like it's gotten harder and harder to maintain that, and thank God for the people that still can, and you know.
Right.
Well, you don't really need the industry anymore. I mean, there's people.
Well, that's what everyone found out. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you.
And.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that you know, there was a period in the 80s, especially in the 90s, when the A&R guys ran everything. They turned out. They decided what to do. They were all powerful. And they were the kings of the universe, the masters of the universe in the music business. But then a funny thing happened. A thing called streaming happened.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
A few years later, these guys are all gone. There are none of them. They're all gone. Yeah. You know what they're doing? They're online selling bull semen. You dig? Not in the music business anymore. You know?
Is that the name of the new EP, Danny? Selling bull semen?
Good idea. I like it. That's a good idea. I'll remember that.
Uh-huh. Did you? So in the last, like I said, we did the album Everybody's Rockin', and on that song, there's a song Paola Blues, where he kind of gets into the Alan Freed and a lot of stuff with payola mm-hmm. and people kind of getting screwed over by publishing being sold. And did any of that, did you experience any of that, or did anyone try to do that to you while you were coming up?
Can yeah. you name any names?
Not really. When I first started off, you know, in 1964, 65, it was a completely different universe and there wasn't a lot of money being made. But the sign, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel was the Beatles, of course, you know, Beatles and the Stones. And they started realizing, oh, there's power here and there's money here. But the thing that I think that really broke it open was Pete Frampton's live album, over 10 million units. And it was after that, people started realizing, hey, there's money in this. And that's when the lawyers started coming in. That's when the lawyers started, you know, taking over the record companies. Mm-hmm. Mm. And that's to me, that was a big sea change right there.
Wow. And now it's kind of going the other way, I guess you could say.
It's going the other way. And, yeah. and you know, listen, nobody is grieving over some of these guys losing their gigs, you know? Mm. You know what yeah. I mean? It's not like anyone is whining away because some A&R guy, you know, isn't in the music business anymore.
Right.
You know?
Selling bulls.
This kind of wiped out a lot of the people that were just in it for the money. Now there's no money. So, you know, find some other business to destroy. You know?
Right.
Well, of course, it's much harder to gain traction now for right. advance because there's so yeah. much stuff. You know, the fact is, yes, it's more democratic in that you can, you don't need a record company to release your record or even to make your record. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, that means everyone's doing it and yep. most of it's crap.
Yeah. Yeah.
The more, you know, the more people doing it, the more mediocre it's going to be. And of course, it's going to be standout stuff, but it's going to be harder to find
yeah.
wading through the crap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's kind of what we're dealing with. We've been at it for almost 10 years now. And, you sort of kind of get into things where it's you start to see that, oh, maybe this person it comes from a lot of money and their, you know, parents maybe got them some studio time. And so there's just like different, it's just a different world now as far as, and it's just constantly changing and evolving and shifting. And it's cool to see that guys like you, incredible legends, are still doing it and can help us younger folk out with kind of trying to wade through the waters of it all. You know, Neil is right. my greatest influence. Neil and Levon are just my like two main guys. But so it's really awesome to hear that advice from you, Danny. I appreciate that.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, ultimately it boils down to having very good song.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. having good singing.
Yeah.
And then going out and playing live and getting people going.
Yeah.
You guys know about that. You got to get them going.
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's what your best shot, because you get them going, an audience going, they'll go home and they'll tell their friends. I saw this band and they were killing it, you know, and then they'll tell other people. And it's kind of always been that way. The word of mouth thing is yeah. the most impressive and yes. The best way.
Yeah, nowadays people don't think of that enough. You know, they don't realize that still matters a lot.
Well, now we have social media.
Right.
Social media is kind of like that word of mouth thing. It's like, hey, you got to check these guys out. And
yeah, but the difference is it's like social media, but it has to be triggered from a live performance.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. Instead of just someone telling someone else at a bar or at work, now you've got social media. It can happen a lot faster.
Instagram, Facebook, or whatever.
Yeah.
But again, social media is like, you know, it's completely inundated with 8 million different people,
right.
you know. So,
yeah,
100%. Again, it's hard to get any traction just through social media because everyone is doing it.
Yep.
And when
yep.
everyone is doing it, that means that lessens your impact.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
Well, you gotta set yourself apart from the crowd, much like Neil Young does.
Yeah.
Every album, exactly. every time.
Yeah.
Well, Danny, yeah. thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us, and thank you for your insights on working with Neil and Landing on Water. And I'm sorry we disagree on that particular album, but
Mike disagrees.
Well, I disagree. Oh, I go, you okay? All right, yes, I disagree.
Throw Mike under the bus.
But we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, man. Thank you very much.
And Danny,
my pleasure.
Was there anything we could let people know to? A charity you're interested in or work of yours, anywhere we can point people that you might want them to go give some praise?
Well, I'd like very much for everybody to check out our album, you know, our EP, and then our album when it comes out.
Slipping and Sliding.
Slipping and Sliding, which is really good. I'd also like everyone to vote.
Yeah. Yes. You know, yeah. Just like yeah. everyone is saying, vote like your life depended on it, because it does.
Absolutely.
You know, so, and, you know, I mean, I give to, you know, I give to several different charities, just like most of us do. I don't need to go into that, though.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, cool. Awesome. Thank you, Danny.
All right, Danny. All right.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for your time, man. All right. We appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah, much love,
my
man.
My pleasure. All right. Take care now, fellas.
You too. Thanks.
Flip his wings like a dove, fell down to the ground, sliding deep in the mud. I got clouds in my eyes, blood on my hands, fire on my feet as I run to my love.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.